I want to thank Brad, even though I know he's on vacation, for inviting me to be here. I first met Brad when he was a student, and I was serving the Mountain View Church in Boulder, and he came to be our preacher for Student Sunday. So I have known Brad a long time, and we worked on several committees together, and it's a joy to be here, and we wish him well on his vacation. Also, Larry is a very dear friend. I feel like it's home. We've known each other for a number of years, and there are a number of people in the congregation that we have known for a couple of years. So, and two daughters. So it's a very comfortable place to be, and I hope that our time together will be meaningful for all of us. I'm sure it will. 2 weeks ago, our 20-year-old granddaughter texted. And yes, and I do text, and ask if she and her boyfriend could come and talk with us about the meaning of life. Well, I was both excited and grateful and a little bit apprehensive and anxious. This is important stuff, and this is the future, and I wish I had all the answers. At this age and stage, aren't we supposed to know the answers? So what was I going to tell her? What were we going to talk about? How often I think all of us on our spiritual journeys wish for some concrete answers. How about an airplane flying overhead with one of those long trailers that tells us the meaning of life? Or a lightning bolt of revelation? Or a dream, a dramatic dream or a vision? Or maybe, for those of you who are older, even a fortune cookie? Doesn't seem to happen very often, does it? And so we look elsewhere for guidance as to the meaning of life. Our scripture today is one of those touchstones for me. We look at part of Micah, the prophet, and we're looking at part of chapter 6, which begins with the question, "With what shall I come before the Lord? And bow myself before God on high. Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body, and for the sin of my soul?" This is preparatory work. It's also ancient work. It's when the people and God were still trying to figure each other out. What's the nature of God? What pleases God? What do I need to do to be a good person and live a good life? Well, in the answers of those days, sacrifice and offerings and appeasement were the word of the day. And so the person here offers burnt offerings of lambs or rams, perhaps, offers valuable oil, 10,000 rivers of oil, or even the firstborn. Ancient offerings and practiced in those days. But suddenly the text shifts, and it's an amazing shift. For it says, in effect, no, God doesn't want any of those things anymore. In effect, doing away with the sacrificial system of the day. And the text goes on to say, "He has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God." So today we're going to talk a little bit about justice. What is justice? What is doing justice? How do we know justice? What is it anyway? Well, coming at it from the backside, I think most of us know injustice when we see it. Years ago, when I was about 8 years old and visiting my relatives in the Deep South during segregation, I remember going shopping in a large department store in Memphis, Tennessee. I was taking a drink from the fountain, and my Aunt Azalea from Mississippi yanked me by the arm and said, "You can't drink there. See the sign? Colored." Big sign. As an 8-year-old from the North, that made absolutely no sense to me at all. For injustice doesn't make sense on any level. It doesn't make sense spiritually or morally or practically or economically or socially or individually. And because of that, I think we know it when we see it. I was interested to reread the words of Dr. Martin Luther King in a speech from 1968. In it, he said, "We are challenged to rid our nation and the world of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, poverty spreads its nagging, prehensile tentacles into hamlets and villages all over our world." Where are the orators today? Where are the orators today? Poor and hungry people are ill-housed. They are ill-nourished. They are shabbily clad. I have seen it in Latin America. I've seen it in Africa. I've seen this poverty in Asia and North America. Well, what a powerful image. Poverty as a monstrous octopus. And a persistent one. 1968 was 45 years ago. Injustice is persistent and nagging and powerful. We know it when we see it. Earlier this year, we all endured the trial of George Zimmerman, accused of killing the 17-year-old black Trayvon Martin. I don't want to get into the discussions about the process or the outcome. It was invariably complicated and messy. But I do want to share the words of a black male journalist written shortly after the verdict was announced. He wrote, "As a parent of black teenage boys, I am left with the question, now what do I do? We used to say, do not run in public, because that might be seen as suspicious, like they'd stolen something. But according to Zimmerman, Martin drew his suspicions, at least in part, because he was walking too slowly. So what do I tell my boys? At what precise pace should a black man walk to avoid suspicion? Injustice is persistent and nagging and powerful." But now let's turn to justice. One simple explanation that we used some years ago in a youth peace camp was, justice is peace, is people having what they need and at least something of what they want. Doing justice was returning to people what belongs to them, or giving to people what they didn't have in the first place. With this concept, we move into the area of human rights, basic human rights offered by the United Nations. The right to food, adequate shelter, clean water, clothing, security, health care, freedom to associate with who you want to associate, to worship the way you want to worship, and to travel where you want to travel, meaningful work. It seems we're having trouble in this country and around the world with justice. As the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and the disparity between the two widens. Where is the justice when 1.29 billion people live on less than $1.25 a day around the world, while the average home in Aspen, Colorado, sells for $6 million? How can we have peace with such disparity? There is no peace without justice. This is the classic haves versus have-nots scenario. Conflicts arise when the haves grow tired of not having, and they decide to do something dramatic or perhaps violent. So a peace that is real for everyone can only begin to happen when more people work toward making sure others have the things they need and some of the things they want. Ensuring justice, which is nagging and persistent and so forth, injustice for all, requires groups of committed and passionate people intentionally and persistently working on behalf of those who are excluded from access to the benefits of our society and denied human rights: the poor, the hungry, the marginalized, the powerless. Now, acts of charity and mercy are absolutely necessary, both for the givers and the receivers. And I understand that you talked about charity and serving others last week. Lives are saved by food and clothing banks, by meals for the homeless, by taking peanut butter and jelly sandwiches down to Civic Center at times, and I know that this church does that, by giving Thanksgiving baskets or Christmas baskets, by adoptive family programs, by prison visitation, all the charity ministries that so many churches are involved with. We are called as Christians to take care of the widow and the orphan, the poor, the imprisoned, and the weak. And we do that well. But doing justice requires more than that. We just had our Bread for the World Sunday at Arvada United Methodist Church. And in one of their educational brochures, there was a chart showing 24 bags of food for the hungry, representing supplies for the hungry. Well, the efforts of all religious and charitable organizations, that's all of us together in the faith community and charitable organizations, the results of that was to supply one of those 24 bags necessary for all the people. That's a small percentage. Charity alone does not suffice. We must confront the systems and the structures and the laws to effect real change. And that's doing justice. But it's hard. It's hard. It's not as easy as feeding the homeless or serving peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, which are absolutely necessary. Justice is a little bit harder. So I want to tell you a story. Perhaps it'll make it a little bit easier. Some of you may have heard this. It's called the Parable of the Babies in the River. There is a village out somewhere, and it is next to a river. One day, a farmer is out there attending to his plot of land, and he's spading and working and so forth. And he looks out, and he sees a baby floating down the river. Well, he's shocked and worried, so he jumps into the water, immediately goes out, and he saves the baby. He brings it back to shore. Well, then, about 4 or 5 days later, he's again out working in his field, and he sees two babies floating down the river. So he says, oh no, I've got to save two babies. So he jumps into the water, he swims out, he grabs the two babies with difficulty, swims back to shore, and rescues them. Well, he realizes that if any more babies appear coming down the river, he's not going to be able to save them. And so he enlists help from his village people. And so some of them are standing along the river while others are working in the fields. Well, few days later, six babies come floating down the river. So, the villagers are mobilized. They jump in, they rescue the six babies, then they bring them back. This goes on with more and more babies coming down the river. And the village says, oh my gosh, we've got to organize ourselves. We can't just let this happen. And so they organize themselves, and they have a team that stands spotting the river. And then they have a team that swims out to rescue the babies. And then they have someone who takes care of them when they get back. And they're all organized, and it's going well for a few days. And then it goes on, and they realize they just cannot, even with an organized plan, save all the babies that are going down the river. So finally, one person says, why don't some of us walk upstream and find out who or what is putting these babies in the river? Well, my engineer husband wants to know lots of questions, but that's a parable, so just let it sit. Just let it sit the way it is, as we do with some of the biblical stories. What it shows us or suggests to us that justice requires different questions. The questions are not how many peanut butter sandwiches can we make, or how many meals can we serve, how many babies can we save, how many Band-Aids can we put on things. It is more, why is this happening? Who or what is doing this? And then it requires different actions. We must confront those structures and powers and systems that allow babies to be thrown into the river, that allow the homeless to be homeless, that allow people to be excluded from their rights. Whether we're concerned about environmental justice or generational justice, that's a new one, by the way, a new one, meaning that are we taking enough care in this world to be sure that it will be good for our following generations? Racial justice, economic justice, whatever our cause, justice demands first that we confront the powers that be and say, enough. Enough gun violence. One child killed every minute. Enough spent on weapons of war. Enough exploiting foreign workers in unsafe environments. Enough predatory and secretive lending practices. Enough exclusion of groups of people from the mainstream and accepted. And so we must act. Dr. King went on to say in his 1968 speech, "I submit that nothing will be done until the people of goodwill put their souls and bodies in motion." And so, doing justice, we church people are called to write letters and blogs, send emails, share on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube about social justice issues, shining a light, as we heard in our hymn, shining a light on the injustices. We're called to sign petitions. We're called to walk the halls of legislatures and Congress, speaking to our representatives on behalf of those who have no voice. We're called to attend city council meetings and school board meetings, practice nonviolence in word and deed, stand on the Capitol steps to demonstrate with others, engage in voter registration drives, give money in socially responsible ways, make personal lifestyle choices which move towards sustainability and less consumption. For we all know in our hearts that injustice doesn't make sense, and we cannot be silent. Well, God has showed us the ways of the beloved community, which we all seek to be, based in kinship with others. Listening, sharing, respecting, practicing nonviolence, doing justice, showing kindness, being humble, and loving. Such loving is not mere sentimentality, not a feeling. It is, as Gandhi said, a lifelong challenge. When another person's welfare means more to you than your own, whenever his or her life means more to you than your own, only then can you say you love. Anything else is just business. Give and take. This is radical concern for the other, radical selflessness, and it's hard. It is hard. Well, the conversation with our granddaughter went well last Monday evening. She came with a list of questions about God's nature and human free will and evolution and a moral life and why do you go to church, believing, salvation, what happens on after death. And the four of us decided that there will always be more questions than there are answers, which is as it should be. But we also agreed that a life well lived in community, respecting others, practicing forgiveness, refusing to judge others, hoping, sharing your talents with the world, recognizing and believing in God's grace, doing justice, being kind, and being humble. All that gives meaning and purpose here and now, with glimpses of what God's kingdom might be. I'm so grateful for that touchstone from Micah.